Testing, 1, 2, 3, testing. Alright, almost there. Testing. Can you do me a favor and test on forlisting.hig, see if I'm up? K105, I guess. It's supposed to be live, that's why. So you go on the leave in spinning. Okay, good. All right, so this is a restart of lecture number 2 in this course on social technical security system modeling and analysis. We had a technical difficulty, and to some extent the technical difficulty occurred because we don't have the right social support system. Now, if you look at the SBC stack, which you read about, is it an ethical issue? Probably not. Is it a legal issue? Probably not. Is it standard operating procedures? What should I have here, either technically or socially, to help me? Go ahead. Correct. If the system doesn't work, do X, do Y. And in many cases, a lot of these complex security systems go astray because of the lack of documentation, the lack of proper social technical analysis. Now, one of the things we talked about in the last lecture is that I will talk about in this lecture, is the term social technical comes from, I wonder where I can stand, but am I standing okay? I'm not used to this room. Oh, so it sees me. Good, good, good. The other one, since you walk away and all of a sudden you're talking to... So one of the beginnings of social technical systems was in 1950 where... And there's an article, I'm going to refer to it, where they were looking at the work system. So first, instead of looking at the management system, you look at the work system. And what is our work system? I talk, you talk, we listen. We look at those basic functions and we try and say, how do we support those functions with technology? So this lecture, of course, we had this before. You've seen this one before. So the assignment is for the IMT 4152. I'm not sure exactly who's online right now or who will be seeing this recorded. I haven't put on my backup. I will start it now just in case. See, I don't trust technology. So we'll record this. So the idea here is I want to inspire you to read and reflect. Mandatory, if you want to pass the course, you should read chapters 1 and 13 and reflect on them. But there are other material there you can read. I'll be going through some of that here and try and, if you want to learn more, you can. I hope you can see this. So I made an interesting suggestion right now, is that I will be changing the order. I had the order before, and if... it was a bit too abstract for the students. So the next lecture we'll be going down to the practical information security management. And we're jumping away from this. So lecture three has been moved around. Because what I just reflecting on it myself is I don't want to be too. So in the next lecture we'll be going on the textbook. And I guess I left the textbook in the room. So there's a textbook in the course and we get into that. That's the next slide. get into that. The Skype lectures, so there are online students. So on Saturday, there was one student that phoned me, had a Skype with it, and on Sunday was another student. And those, if they want, they can book a time for Sunday at 10 o'clock for questions. And you can also book times at that time. Say we have, and I'd be sort of moving these up and depending on how the course is going and the feedback I'm getting. But what I find is sometimes a 15-minute Skype session can save everybody a lot of time and increase the grades. That's the textbook. That's the book we'll be looking at in the next lecture on the 4th. You should scan, and not necessarily, I say scan, not necessarily read. I'll be going through it in such a way that you will see what's important. If you do read the textbook, you see what it is. It's basically a manual and how you build up a roadmap in information security management. So there's a lot of tick-in-the-box type of things. It's like a pilot jumping on a plane saying, check, 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 check. So it's good reading, very difficult to teach, because everybody can read their own tick boxes. This is the extra reading, if you're interested. It's called The Story of Social Technical Design, and it gives a philosophical statement about what social technical design is. As I say, it started in the 50s, and it analyzes why it's went out of fashion. And interesting enough, it's come back in fashion. And I show you some of my proof points on that. So that's an extra reading. Those that speak Norwegian, there's a lot of stuff going on, so there's a lot of resources when you're taking this course. I'm involved in these types of activities. So the Norwegian government wants to change the security laws. And I'm involved in discussing and debating what's going on. And all this information is open. So going back to the SBC model, we have ethics, laws, and policies. How will these new Norwegian security policies affect your job if you're working in Norway in terms of the policies and technology you'll be using? If you're interested, you can register for this online session on the 28th of April and watch. You can see all the where your tax money is going in Norway. But of course, this is in Norwegian. And as I say, when you're looking at this, think about how, and we get into a bit when I did an analysis of the 1987 Computer Security Act in the United States. So I tried to trace how the change in the law affected the United States. And interesting enough, believe it or not, history is repeating itself. So a lot of people, there's a rhyme from Hemingway that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes badly. And it's interesting what the government did from the first proposition. It's going to be mandating that every critical infrastructure has to have a documented risk analysis. In this case, and this is Norwegian, unfortunately, but it has to do with how the new law is going to affect personal integrity and privacy. And you can watch it for free. Here's another thing you can watch for free. This is the poster boy of information security, Bruce Schneier. Everybody seems to think that he knows what he's talking about. And guess what? He discovered social technical systems. Took him 15 years, but hey, he's a slow reader. So he has an hour presentation, so you can listen to an hour presentation on social technical approach to large-scale systems. These are things you can do on the side, the part of the course, as I say, you can. And that's the important thing in this course. I'm inspiring you to read this material and find other material. That's why I want you to do this assignment. I want you to go out and look at incidents and use what you're doing to see what's going on in the world out there and see if you can apply it directly. I think I'm missing one here. Oh well. I have a past presentation. I'm going to have to go back to my slide package. It seemed that something has been corrupted here. But there's a last year at this time, I presented social technical modeling and security value chain at the Institute for Political Studies, NUPI. It's in Swedish, Norwegian, and English. But I will be presenting here in English about what a social technical value chain is. But going back to the purpose of this course again, and that's the word I'm saying again, that's why I'm giving you all this material. You're supposed to learn in a master's program how to do independent research. I'm not supposed to hold your hand. If I will hold your hand to get a C, but if you want to get a B, you're going to have to go out and start looking at other things. Because you're supposed to learn to be an independent researcher in the master's. The assignment, this is the instructions that will be posted. First, I've opened up a task 1A in Fronter. And there you're supposed to post what incident or case or area you want to do a social technical analysis of. When you get approval for that, you can go ahead and start writing the assignment. I suggest one of the things, it's easy to find something interesting, but it might be difficult to do a social technical analysis of it. And it's the best case is that you can go to past incidents, and if somebody else has done some sort of analysis on it, it doesn't have to be social technical. There's a lot of cases, like say the Heartbleed. A lot of people have discussed the situation with the Heartbleed vulnerability that happened 2 years ago. This is a suggested outline. It's actually quite free the way you want to word it. If you want to word it as a large monogram, that's fine, but I suggest the easiest way is to use this structure. In the introduction, you talk about the system above, the system below, and the system in focus. So when you're doing social technical analysis, we say, in using living systems theory, is you look at, in this case, we look at the organization. So going back to analysis, sorry I didn't get your name, what was it? What your name is? Heidi? Okay. So what's interesting is that when we do analysis of why the projector didn't work, as I say, it's either individual, somebody else, or the system. In this case, the first thing was me. So that's the level. You have the individual, and then you have the organization, and then you have the system. And you have to decide when you're analyzing something, what's the system in focus? So if you're a consultant, okay, my consultant assignment is something for Telenor. What's the system above Telenor? Does anybody know? In Norway? It's called NCOM. Google NCOM. NCOM is the regulator that sets the laws and does the inspection of Telenor security. So that's the system. I mean, who's above NCOM? The government. And what's interesting in certain systems is that NSM is actually beside NCOM. It's not above NCOM. Of course, NSM believes it's above NCOM, but you can see how there's a sort of a relationship. So to understand the power structure of the system you're doing, you have to see who's on top and who's on the bottom. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. Look at the system. Have a system in focus. There's usually a system below and usually a system above. Then describe what happened and to whom. Why did it happen? Is there a social reason for having? Is it a technical reason? Is it a social technical reason? So I'm suggesting that a social technical reason is something where there's a combination. So social technical control is a new type of control. That's where the control is so dependent on the interface between the social control and the technical control. And in the conclusion, if you're doing a white hat analysis, you can suggest social technical mitigation techniques. If you're doing a black hat analysis, you can suggest to someone how they can actually crash the system even more. So if you're interested, so that's the assignment. Go ahead. As I say, it's an independent study, and I suggest the framework. It's 4 to 5 pages. It makes it easier for you to mark, but a lot of people find it restrictive. They're saying, well, this is not really ethical, this is not really legal, so I don't know what to do with it, but it's a reason. So, I'm not... You see in the exercise today how the framework can help. And if you read the material I've developed, the thesis, you can see how that can work. So the question was, do you have to use the SBC framework, the Security by Consensus framework? And the answer is no. As I say, I didn't say it was because of legal reasons, because of ethical reasons. That's just something I found. If you find a different way of categorizing social controls, that's fine. This is just a 4 to 5 page assignment. Thank you for the question. Any other questions about the assignment? And you have some past assignments I posted, so you can read them. The assignment sort of changes in nature, so it's not exactly the same, but you get the gist of it. So we're going to review last lecture, and I go through chapters 1, 2, 6, and 13. Now, in the last lecture, we talked about this whole business about modeling. Why do we model? And if anybody remembers, how does a garage opener work for a kid? Does anybody remember the joke? How did the ATM work? The father was explaining the ATM to the child. What? Yeah, go ahead. All right. And that's what happens in reality, is that everybody has their world view, and a large portion of the people try and see things that match the worldview. They don't want the worldview, so they keep a model working and working again. And there are different mental models, and this is one of the mental models we're going to be talking about. Now, when you're looking at the slide package, as I say, I have a lot of embedded information. So, this is a link where I'm discussing with another professor our philosophy for teaching. It's a 10-minute link. You won't hear it on the thing. I haven't plugged in the sound connection, so you won't hear it. And you see my thing's not working, but it should work for you, depending on your flash version, of course.
My name is Dorian Wolski, and I have with me Louise Engstrom, and we're going to have a discussion for this agreement.
Okay. So I embed a lot of information in the slides. You don't have to see it, but it's of interest. And the reason we're having this discussion is actually the same reason why I changed the slide package. Sorry, here. It's always the case. As you see here, this whole philosophical principle, on the left you have the theories, on the right you have the practices. And then when it comes to the problem of information security, we have information systems and we have IT systems. And as a teacher, I have to figure out where to start. But the idea in reality is that you should go around the whole loop. I should be able to give you a practical problem. You should match that practical problem to a theoretical issue in information systems. you should be able to match a theoretical problem in information systems to a problem in computer science, and you should be able to match a computer science problem to a problem in practical computer operations. And in the slide package, I have a presentation where I do a walk around like that. Because in reality, that's what will happen. You'll be put down someplace, and in university, we give you the theoretical stuff, and then you have to use the practical stuff. And you spent 5 years here, of course, to learn how, when you go out there and something's wrong, you can use theory. Because if it was just practice, why do you spend 5 years here? Go out and practice. All right, so you can read that. That gives a philosophical read and watch that video. And then I try and get a bit scientific, and in the next lecture I'll be talking about independent and dependent variables. Does everybody know what a independent and dependent variable is? You took a course in methods, right? Is insecurity a dependent or independent variable? Depending on the experiment. I change something and I measure something. Which one do I measure and which one do I change in an experiment? I'm not going to give you the answer, but yeah. So going back to the same model again, this is classical stuff. And there are two approaches. One is that you look at what happens. That's what you're doing now. You're making observations. And you're making generalizations. In this case, you find a case. You observe it. But are you observing it through what? You're observing through the lens of the social technical model, the mental model, the SBC model. So in a sense, that model is a hypothesis. That hypothesis says that social technical modeling can cover about 80 to 90% of the reasons things go wrong. That's the hypothesis. They can explain what goes wrong. And they can predict what will go wrong with a given degree of certainty. And this is what we talked before, the model we says this is the model you should have, that every system you look at has a living system in it. It has an abstract system, a model, and there are concrete systems. And there's always a gap between them. And the living system wants to influence, observe, measure, understand, explain, predict, and control that gap. That's what your job is. Because the more of the gap is there, the more insecure the system's going to be. Insecure in the sense you can't predict it. So, this is an exercise I do sometimes. It's difficult. I call it PowerPoint karaoke. I didn't get your name. Sonia. Can you talk to the slide now? What's the slide saying? It says gap. What's the gap? What's the on the other side? What we can do with IT and what we can abuse with IT. So what we can do with technology and what we can control with technology is not always the same. So I can use IT systems to break systems and I can use IT systems to protect systems. And there's a gap between that. All right? Thank you, son. And you can have new laws. You can have social controls. Or you can build in technical controls. What's interesting, I take the subway in Oslo a lot too, right? And it's so interesting is how they have social technical controls to try and figure out how they should get people to pay. And they introduced the new digital watermarking, as everybody know it, when you buy a ticket and you can look at it. And it's interesting how that works. And what's good about it, in my mind, is they analyzed how the conductor actually checks the ticket. So when you buy a ticket on your app, you get the picture of the day. Let's see if I have it here. And what that did is it really helps this guy move along, doing it fine. I don't know if I still have it. No, the picture's gone. So I get a picture of something. It's somebody on a beach, it's whatever. And the picture flashes every 3 seconds. So I can't use a screen capture thing to get it. And that's all he looks at. He doesn't look at the ticket to say where it's going. It's just that whether that picture is there. And what they're doing is they're looking at who, the social side of it. This guy has to check all these tickets. How does he do it? And how often do we have to check it? So it's a mixture of technology and personnel in terms of finding the ticket. And I can see the other thing. If you're checking something and you're checking the same number all the time, does the ticket say 23? Does the ticket say 23? Every day. What would happen? Your mind would just rub it out. But if you're a checker and the picture is something of a volleyball or a nice summer day, you might have a tendency to check it more often. So if you use the NSB app, you see that. Next time I see if I can have it on it. Did anybody... Okay, no one has admitted to reading chapter one, so that's fine. There's a joke in chapter one. I was going to ask you which one has gotten the joke. Now, if you look at the picture, I'm saying this is the scheme of things. In the world, we have technical insecurity. We have social insecurity. We have natural insecurity. And we have supernatural insecurity. Right? So I'm trying to be academic in this and say, okay, I'm getting all the different types of insecurity. And I have a quote back that why I'm doing this is that it has been reported in the popular press that a consultant in Lisbon, Portugal, was called in to cure a computer that was ringing alarms in the night. By reciting prayers from St. Mark, he was able to correct the situation. So, I don't know, maybe the reason that's not working K102 is because of me. I don't know, maybe I'm a sort of a... Maybe I should go in and pray a bit more before to see if I get the machine to work next time. I see if that works sometimes. Why am I doing this joke? Is because how did this work? I mean, this is something being reported. You can go back and reference it, whatever. And some people believe this, right? Going back to this whole issue of social technical. So empirically, what I did is in 1992, I went out and I asked information security office in Sweden what they did. So I said that day. So I don't know. Say as students, what does a typical student do in a day? And I asked, do you do this? Do you do this? Do you do this? And what we know from these studies is that the average Norwegian student spends 21 hours a week studying. So most of you guys above average, I hope. So I went around and asked this. And I also asked, okay, if you're going to rate your job on what you're doing on a social technical scale, where would you rate it? So I asked 9 security officers, and 8 of them said it was more social than technical. So these are information security managers. The other thing I did is I asked them, what did you do yesterday? I asked 600. You can read the report. And about 60 to 70% of them were actually educating the staff how to do security. And one of the reasons I actually did this report is that the secret police in SAPO, who a friend of mine, when he goes to incident, he's going, this information that this was happening was in the log. Who reads the log? I mean, you're the security manager, you read the log? None of them read the log. They couldn't find anybody who actually read the log in this time. So this was 92. So they had these logs being produced, and no one was reading them. We said, okay, so what are these guys getting paid to do? And they were getting paid to talk about PowerPoints and present information security and security awareness. And they go, oops, no one's really been assigned to read the log. Another example of social technical systems. And in that report, I talk about the whole business about there are different types of jobs. You have the amount of exceptions you deal with. So as a security officer, do you deal with many exceptions? And what do you use logic to figure it out, or do you use intuition? So I asked the security people, these nine officers, okay, do you have few exceptions in your job, and you have to use intuition to solve it? Or do you have routine technology or engineering technology in your job? And only two of them here said they had engineering. Most of the other ones were up here. So it's a way of looking at the actual work. Do you use logic or do you use intuition to do security management and security analysis? And these are what these people who call themselves security professionals said they did. This is a study done in 1992. If anybody wants to I'd be interested to see this study repeated to see if anything has changed. If you're interested in the article, it's in the extra reading. All right, going back to this model, I passed around this model, I guess it's in the other room. And what this model says is that if you're going to observe a system, a company, there are different ways of observing it. But you go in, you analyze, what methods do we use at HEAG, or NEAG, or whatever we call ourselves now, to support teachers? What machines do we have to do it? What culture do we have to do it? What structure? Right? And what structure, going back to structure, so we have a support unit called IT support. That's the power structure, right? They're supposed to give me support. We have a culture saying, well, they support me between 9 and 5, 9 and 4. Right? That's the culture. Norway closes at 3:30. If you want to attack a system in Norway, do it at 6 o'clock. All right, so this is the model. And what we say, these are common, identifiable, and observable characteristics of any human organization. And in order for these to measure the security in the system, you need a balance. If the method doesn't match the machine, if the method doesn't match the culture, if the method doesn't match the structure, there will be gaps. And these gaps can lead to security problems. What I had you do in lab one is I wanted you to look at a high system level, so just reviewing that, right? In this case, you were looking at how different empires changed. And what this diagram is trying to say, when you do the exercise, if you go back to this model, what is it that causes it? So you just have to start somewhere. Was it because, when you do your analysis, the reason that I did not have support at 4 o'clock, is that a structural issue or a cultural issue? Is that why it happened? Is it a method issue? What is the reason something goes wrong? What is the reason something goes good? And in the exercise, we looked at the British one and how their method affected the culture at one level, and then the culture affected something else at another level. So this is trying to get a chain of causality between the different levels and between the different objects. It's a way of thinking about the problem. And that's what you did at lab one. Now some of you just did lab one, the first one. You can go look at it and do other ones. And this is what you'd be required to do for the exam too. You're going to look at a problem and then... Now, when you're reading chapter one, to understand the background to chapter one was written, is we had a problem in information security in the 80s. All the former models for trying to do security weren't good enough. They knew that. So they had what is called a paradigm problem. And because of this paradigm problem, this whole business when I got in, the Clark Wilson model was invented, the Biba Bella Podler model was done in the 70s. And what's interesting is you had something in the computer branch, you had something called Multrix. How many people here know what Unix is? How many people know what GNU is? What's GNU? What does GNU stand for? Why is it called Unix? Unix is not Multrix. So the people who designed the Unix, Thompson and Ritchie, they were working on the Multrix project. They got so frustrated with it that they moved over and created their own operating system called Unix. And it's called Unix as a joke against Multrix. So it's a brief history. So this started off in MIT, Bell Labs. Bell came out in 1969. So here they're trying to use formal methods to define a secure operating system. It was at an A1 level, and you can read a bit about that here. And basically we knew how, at that time, how to create a circle structure and a ring architecture to have a secure enough operating system for top secret information in the U.S. military. Couldn't make any money on it. We couldn't change anything. What came out of that? Unix. And Unix, and we used to say in English, there's a term called oxymoron. Have you ever heard that expression? It's a contradictory term. So if you say secure Unix, that's an oxymoron. That means there's no such thing as secure Unix. And when I was working at the time, the biggest problem with Unix was that every fork was a new file, so it was a file system. There was no physical security in it whatsoever. So we had a hard time making Unix secure. And basically that's because it was designed to some extent from Multrix that was highly secure, A1 secure and proven secure, but in the end no one had made any money on it. So what Chapter 1 is trying to formulate the problem, and the problem is this, is that how do you represent complex social systems in mathematical models? And what we found that we couldn't find mathematical models that were good enough to model the complexity of the systems in real life. We can model certain things, but not everything. So the idea behind the social technical modeling is to find a model that is good enough to secure a system. And we start off with an abstract model as a thinking aid. So one of the models we have is built on something called the Frisco framework, and the SBC model is built on that. And that's the model of communicating systems. And communicating systems have a stack. And the stack you see on the left-hand side is you have a physical system that communicates, and that's basically created by media. You have an empirical system, or the abstract system, and that's the entropy. Then you have syntax, and then you have semantics, and then you have pragmatics, and then you have social. You can read about this in the Frisco report. So what happens is when you have two systems communicating, they use this stack to communicate. So first, for us to communicate, we have to have a physical system. We have airways, we have mic. And then we have to have entropy, and we have to have syntax. What's the syntax? Syntax is, I'm speaking in this case with vowels and consonants. And these vowels and consonants have a meaning, and that's the semantics. And what's the intention? The intention is to teach you practical things, and the social, the interests and beliefs are shared among us. So if you take that model, what you have in any communication systems, you have a data layer, you have an information layer, and you have a knowledge layer. And how do you translate that into in a system that we could use? Hold on. Does anybody know the systems of the lights? That's interesting. Can I have the lights off, or is it too? It's easier to read, I guess. So what happens here, going back to this, the SPC model says that in this case, what the model is trying to represent is that if you have a layer of stacks. So this guy here, if he's going to make a decision whether to send a file over internet unencrypted, that information is classified as open or secret or top secret or cosmic secret. Does anybody know what cosmic secret is? It's actually an official term in NATO. So you have to have cosmic status. You can look it up. That's the classification. Yeah. Top secret, and then you have cosmic. I don't have cosmic. I'm not too understand. So that guy has to make a decision. He has to look at the policies, and the policies are based on laws, and the laws are based on ethics. And that's the social controls that he has to make a decision. But below him, he has an application that's doing something. And below that application, you have an operating system that's doing something. And that operating system is sitting on hardware. And in order for the system to be secure, all these things have to align. If there's a mistake in the operating system, and in order to have these things is that what you have is you have one bit of information, and you have to have what we call ethical headers. So you have to have information that defines how that data will be transferred ethically, legally, policy, application, operating system, and hardware. So what it's saying is that what we're trying to measure with this, what we're trying to capture with this social technical model is to understand the dynamics of social technical control. On the left, you have a system that's secure because it has the right dynamics. On the right, you have a system that is insecure. So the culture wants to do something, but the structure says no. The culture wants to do something, but the machine's saying no. The culture wants to do something, but the method says no. This system is insecure. Then we take this model and we repeat it over and over again. So in this case, you see that at the individual level, I have a certain value system, that's culture. I have a certain structure, as my wife decides most. I have a certain method, and I use certain machines. And the organization has the same, the nation has the same, etc. So you can abstract that. And in this case, I have NATO deciding something at in Norway. The new security law is based on NATO. Right now, the law was changed to have, if you're going to deal with secure objects, you have to be NATO cleared, and now it says Norwegian cleared. And that affects the individual. So if a system goes out of balance, how do you put it back in balance? The idea is to use, as you're using in the other textbook, is to use a checklist. So every time something is introduced into the system, does this new technology have any ethical implementations? Does it have any legal consequences? Does it have any policy consequences? Does it affect the operating system or the hardware? This is a checklist. That's what a social technical analysis is about. Okay, so you use that to understand the dynamics of what's going on in an organization. You use the culture, structure, method, machine model, and to make mitigation recommendations, you use the SPC model. I don't know why this is going this way. And that's the end of chapter one. We don't have time for this because I don't know what's going on here, but... You guys can have a 5-minute break, and then say a 2-minute break, or can you stay another half an hour to get through it? Anybody? I see no heads saying anything. Half an hour, everybody? Okay. I thought I had a cup of coffee. Okay. I'm going to take just a minute. Okay. I'm going to see if my... You can try this here now. You see what I'm saying in terms of the social technical thing now, and you're going to be doing research. In your master's thesis, do you want to go deep into computer science, information systems, system science, criminology, etc. You can discuss with your neighbor where do you want to go, broad or deep, and why. So chapter 2 in the thesis, whatever, it's looking at how you build a security stack by starting at the top. So it starts looking at, sorry about this. So if you want to stop crime, I'm quoting a professor that I used to work under way back in the 80s. His name was Knut Sverri. It's quite fun working with him because he was with the Oslo police when the Nazis invaded Norway. So he had a hard time because he was a police officer during the Nazi, and you know, it was a really tough, how are you going to manage that? Because people are breaking laws that are unethical. And how do you deal with that situation? So you can see here what's saying that, so that I started off by studying ethics. What did I study? What I studied was, and we don't have much time this way, was that I compared Swedish and Canadian information security students in terms of the ethical differences. And what was interesting there in terms of what they valued was is that in the Scandinavian cultures, you have a concept, more in Sweden, less in Norway, of allemansrätt. I don't know if anybody here is... Can you explain allemansrätt to Stephen? Stephen's not from Norway. You can't have private property like they have signs in other places. And why is that? And why do they value that? So the situation was interesting because there's a lot of use of company equipment in Sweden, and basically if the machine's not being used, why can't I have allemansrätt in cyberspace? So it's how the physical ethics sort of start migrate. I don't know if that's changing now, but I found that in the study. You can read about it. So what's important in the chapter is to get how technology, when it changes, you see how the old ethics have to adapt and develop new value systems. So one of the reasons you have allemansrätt is that there are different explanations ethnographically about it, but is that since you, in Sweden, you're allowed to pick mushrooms and berries because the farmer didn't do anything to make it that those mushrooms are there. You're not allowed to pick things that he's cultivated. But if he or she hasn't done anything to do it, how can he own it? So ownership has to do with adding utility. And every time you get new technology, we have to figure out whether the old ethics work or they don't work. As I had in a presentation before, is enabling someone to copy the same thing as copying? Pirate Bay. That's what they said. We don't believe it, many of us, but the law said it. And this will adapt itself, and the system will find new ways of dealing. It's not as if it's a constant thing. Okay, so now I'm hopping to chapter 6 in the one that you can read or not read. It's a good chapter in a sense, is what I did is I took the models of computer crime abuse in the 90s, and I modeled them. And this is a list of all the different ways you can break into a computer system in the 90s. And then, the slide's difficult to see, but you can see it in the text. And then what I did was, you can see on the left, I look at all these computer crimes. I had this typology, ontology of abuse mechanisms. So I looked at, and then I looked at the National Computer Security Mitigation Standards. There was something called TSEC, which is the American, ITSEC was the European, and CTSEC was with the Canadian. I said, well, how do, if you had a B1 system, would this crime have been committed? Does it actually mitigate the reasons for this crime? And that's what that chapter is about. Do computer security models model computer crime? And the answer was no. So, well, what's the model for then? It helps consultants, I think, but it doesn't necessarily stop crime. And that's what that chapter's about. You can read it. I say I studied 42 computer crime cases and compared them to 3 different national security mitigation structures. And you can see that's the case reports and then the matching. So say that the purpose, and then you really have to understand how these requirements are written to do that matching. I'm not asking you to do that, but I wanted to show you how it's done. So basically the conclusion of the chapter is that you have these theories. The Norwegian government is asking for a new security law. That so law should be good enough to make sure that Norway doesn't give away all its secrets. That's basically the hypothesis in the law, right? And does it match what happens? And if it doesn't match, then we have to get a new model. That's basically what the chapter says there. Now, chapters 11 and 12, before you get to chapter 13, is I took the model and I used it to analyze what was going on in the United States in 1987, etc. So, basically it follows the process that you have principles are developed, they have to be generate policies, the policies generate requirements, the requirements are implemented, and then you have to test it. That's basically the waterfall model to developing stuff. And the diagram shows is that it's out of sync. So they start off one thing, they have principles, they have policies, and the policies generate this, they generate that, and that's what the diagram and the chapter is talking about. So I found that United States, this is the idea model, but then they do it in the wrong order. And then I mapped this one here in the article, how United States has an ethical layer, they have a legal layer, they have an administrative layer, operational layer, and a technical layer. And what's interesting is that the top layers have gone through one cycle, one generation, and the technical layers have gone through 2 generations. So by the time they figure out how to deal with mainframe computers, hey, we got client-server architectures. Oops. And by the time we figure out how to do client-server architectures, we have cloud computing. So technology changes, and how do the technical control mechanisms, going back to that slide, the technical systems develop quicker than the social control mechanisms. And you can identify where these gaps occur. And as I say, what this one does is model all those different ones. Now, chapter 13 is based on, as I say, Knut Sverri, who's a specialist in victimology. So when you're looking at computer crime, you're looking at any crime, you have a basic model. Is you have a potential offender, someone who basically wants to steal assets or harm a victim. And between me and the victim, you have technical barriers and social barriers. The potential victim is attacker is looking for opportunity structure. And this is the basic model. So you see on the right, that's the same thing there, is that you have potential offenders, and they're looking at the model, and you have potential victims, and they have the SBC model. And this is built on the fact that I looked at these computer crime cases. You can read about them. And I said, okay, crime X basically was 80% weak social controls and 20% technical controls. And I made a summary of these different types of ones. And then I tested the SBC model, and you have this now in your exercise. How much time we have? And you look at this and say, all right, this guy says this victim is describing what happened to them. And that's what you get all the time. Many times you don't get the perpetrator. And that's the interesting thing about victimology, is that the person who do the crime, they lie a lot by definition. So they usually don't tell the truth. But you get a lot of good information from the victims, because they're trying to tell you everything. But it's not structured. So you have to structure that information. And that's what the SBC model is designed for. And that's the idea here in your exercise, is that here, and this is Norwegian, sorry, but it says, okay, the problem with Java, that's sort of a below application problem, and that's how the bank, that's a lot of people were not updating the Java, and that's how the system was weak. And of course, the criminal says, all right, I can take advantage of this opportunity. And if that's not there, okay, they have insecure operating systems, all right? They take advantage of that. If that doesn't work, they don't really understand how remote support works. So I can phone them up and say, hi, I'm from Microsoft. How are you today? Steven, how's your computer? Is it doing fine? Hi, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we're going to have to reboot the system, so we have to do remote login here. Can you give me your password and we see what happens? Thank you very much. It's been very helpful. I don't need to have a fancy cracking mechanism if I have a good voice. And these are examples in your lab too. So this is an example of how a hacker is using something at another layer. So what happens is that we don't really have the ethical structure to deal with some of these types of crimes. So the hackers take advantage of that. In this case, that's what that article describes. And in this case, in your lab here, you have the same thing. So this is a victim, and then you can analyze what's going on. All right. So this presentation is a presentation I made at NUPI. You can actually just go online and watch it, and I give you a link to that presentation. I made it last year. It's 15 minutes. About what I call the security value chain. I have 15 minutes to go through that. So what happens now, to understand what the value chain is about, this is going to be very quick. I did in 15 minutes there, but I was planning on spending 45 minutes with you guys, but we had some technical difficulties, so I'm going to go very quickly here. And basically what I'm doing is, this is something I actually built on after my doctoral studies. So I took the social technical model and I applied what I do in industry and how I made money in industry, which I use the security value chain. As you see here, everybody understands the whole concept of the value chain. What's the good of that lock if you have a shoelace keeping it together, right? So a value chain is how different industries connect together to add value to something. So what sort of value chains do we have in security? This is an example of the audio value chain. This is when, we talked about it before, when you guys listen to a record, this is done in 2002, so it's a bit old, but the person who creates the song in Sweden, the IPR owner, gets about 5%. So every song, whatever, gets 5%. The content provider gets about 11%, the media distributor gets 7%, number two gets that, and the etc. So every time you have a product or service going on, everybody's taking their piece of the pie. And if it has to work, why is Spotify working now and not working before? Is they decide, okay, we're going to cut the middleman, and we're going to give the artist 2%, and we're going to take 4%. So you cut the value chain. Here's an example of value chain in the mobile network for content providers, and what you have is that so you have people that produce content, you have the people that manage content, the host content, access the content, and market the content. And what you see below is something called a break-even curve. So you invest in something and it takes you 3 years to start making money on it. And if somebody in the middle of the value chain, you see here, the content hosting, is not going to make enough money on it, they're not going to allow the service to get through. So for example now, here's an example of a concrete value chain when it comes to security. You make money on secure hardware, you make money on secure software, you make millions on secure systems, and you make money on secure services. That's an example of a value chain. And you see here, this is from 2000 to 2005. So access control systems, they make so much money. Security makes so much money. Services make so much money. So every time you have a security solution, everybody's going to have to take the piece of the pie. And at that time, why is the firewall market so difficult? Someone has decided to include firewalls in the operating system. They want to disintermediate the firewall providers, right? So every business solution has that situation. Do you want to make money on the hardware, the software, the system, the services? What's interesting today in the world is you have this situation. We have a global security value chain, right? Where's all the hardware coming from? Who's making money on the software? Who's making money on the systems, and who's making money on the services? So we have a global security value chain in the world today. And then you have the different layers, right? It gets very complex. So you have communication buyers, you have communication providers, you have communication sellers, and everybody's selling software, systems, and services, right? And how cloud's going to make that difference. So the buyers have a cloud, the sellers have a cloud, and then you have the communication provider. And that's what's going on in the world today, right? Is the communication providers, Chinese, Swedish, Norwegian, the sellers, the cloud. Where do you buy the cloud from? Where should it be? And what's the laws saying about that? The Norwegians say that your private information can't be in a cloud in the United States. Right? Because it doesn't have... That was the whole thing about a year ago about the agreeing to the privacy laws in Europe. Did you have the safe harbor law? Right. I've worked with public-private partnership. That's me in Pakistan in 2008 writing this communication security policy for the Pakistan government. And it was based on this security value chain. This is also an example when I worked at Ericsson. You can see here the value chain, the abstract value chain, is made up of three abstract concepts. In security, you deter somebody, you spend money on deterring somebody. If you can't deter them from making a crime, you have to protect, you spend money on that. If your protection system doesn't work, you're going to have to spend money on detecting that the system doesn't work. If detection doesn't work, you're going to have to spend money on responding. And if all that doesn't work, you're going to have to spend money on recovery. Insurance, yes. If detection doesn't work, recovery usually then. Recovery. That means you have insurance. Then you have insurance. Right? Okay? And then you just wasted money. Oh, you say in terms of the logic of the value chain. What this is trying to isolate is that you can spend money on all these different ones. If you spend all your money, I'm going to give you 100 units of security. where are you going to spend that money? And what you find, what companies do, what organizations do, and when crime's committed, someone spent too much money on protection and nothing on detection. Or they spent too much money on detection and not enough money on detection, so the response system doesn't work. So this is what is called a mental budget. And what's interesting, if one is interested, I studied this, and Norwegians and Swedes spend differently on this model. Norwegians spend more money on protection. The Swedes spend more money on detection and response in the tests we did. So I have a report on that when I modeled that. So this is the mental model of security. If I give you 100 units of security, where are you going to spend your money? Where did Saddam Hussein spend his money on security? Deter. You go against me, I'm going to kill you. So you have to keep up a huge force to keep that down, right? And when the deterrence wasn't there, it fell down like a house of cards. So every security problem has this. This is an abstract model on security. And this is the way people spend their money. And this is an example, if you read the article, about how in the telecom network, where are you going to spend your money? Are you going to detect at the node, the site, or the network? Where should you have your intrusion detection system? Should it be on the host or should it be in the network? These are the same sort of decisions you have to make, because that affects the throughput. And then what you do is you have different types of functionality. So in a system, you have a system that's taking machine cycles to protect, taking machine cycles to detect, taking machine cycles to respond, and taking machine cycles to recover. Right? So if you look at it from a technical perspective, security has that. I already have so many machine cycles. So many recycles in the CPU are going for protection, detection, response, and recovery. And so when I was designing these systems, I was the security architect. I would have to figure out my budget. Because, I mean, the call has to go through and I can only have 1 millisecond delay or I get jitter. Yeah, but I have to do recovery now. No, you can't, because you're going to delay the message, the protocol. So I have to work with these constraints in practice. And what's interesting, you see how there are different mental models for spending. We talked about mental models before. I've studied different cultures. So if he's looking at the total spending budget, some people would spend this way. Then you can read reports I've done this. So this is an example of a mental model. And this is an example of the report I had with this, the Swedes, how they spent. Now what I did is I looked at the same organization and I asked them how they were spending money. So this is this was a bank operating in Norway and Sweden. And I asked them, how are you spending your security budget here? The exact same problem. And the Swedes spent it that way and the Norwegians spent it that way. Right? But it's only one study, so you can't, it's not, you know, this is one thing. So if we look at this value chain here, we have to decide in Norway, who should do the security? Is it a public thing, is it a public-private, or is it a private thing? A lot depends on what we call the RAC model, which is who has the responsibility, the authority, and competence to deal with this. And I won't get into this now, time-wise. You can read a bit about how this model works in situational awareness in the military. So when I'm looking at a social technical system, I say, okay, who has the technical competence, who has the responsibility, and who has the authority? What's example of that situation? The fact that you need special characters in a password. Who has the authority to decide what's the special character? Is it you? Who has the competence to decide what is a special character? Is it you or is it somebody else? Again, it's the same thing here. And if you take this model, as we talked before about culture, structure, methods, and machines, and superimpose this on the problem of cybersecurity in Norway, is
who has the right to deter a cyber attack? Who's the authorities? Do you as an individual have the right to do that? Do you have special organizations in Norway that are designed to deter against cyber attack? Yeah, it's called Cyberforsvaret. Who has the right to prevent, detect, respond, and recover? Does the Norwegian military have the right to go in and monitor my firewall? Right? No? But I'm saying this is an example how I'm using the model to explain how a nation works. A nation spends so much money deterring, a nation spends so much money preventing, so much money detecting, so much money responding, and so much money recovering. How does the nation state spend that? How is the nation state organized? And what you see, of course, is that the military have a certain culture, structure, methods, and machines. The police have certain culture, methods, and machines. NSM has certain culture, methods, and machines. And when these things don't align, things don't work. An organization have certain... Most organizations don't have separate units that are set up to deter. They have one organization that has to deal with deter, prevent, detect, respond. It's called the security department or whatever. And you as an individual, you don't have anything. You have to do all those things together, right? So this is the way how different types of security problems on an abstract layer are dealt with. You have the value chain. You have the cultural and structure, and you have the spending models. What's interesting, if you go back to the RAC in this area, if you do an analysis, who has the competence to deter, and who has the authority to deter, and who has the responsibility to deter? What you see, there's always a discrepancy. Often in a situation, the one that has the competence, they don't have the authority. So... should cyber security be under the Minister of Defense or the Minister of Justice? Who has the authority to go in and check my firewall for criminal activities? It's under the Minister of Justice. Do they have the competence to understand when spyware has been put in by a third state? And you always have this problem. This is a constant problem in organizations, in nations, and with individuals. How is the responsibility for security managed? How is authority managed? And how is competence managed? In many cases, the persons that have the authority don't have the competence. As you see here, that's a... So what we have to look at is that if you're looking at the situation about how to deal with... if you use the security value chain, the SBC model, these abstract models, try and figure out where the weak links are. Try and figure out who has the responsibility, authority, and competence to deal with this. And have a long-term, short-term strategy to do this. So who has the authority, the competence, the responsibility, and the authority to deal with cybercrime? It's not the military, of course. It's the police, whatever. So that was the... took 13 minutes. We can talk a little bit more about it. You can read about it. You can watch it on when I made the presentation. Very few people understand it. Because I'm taking three abstract models. As you know, out in the big world, they don't like abstract models. They want practical ones. But you have the chance now, while you're studying, to think abstractly. And then apply it to something practical. So go out now with your assignment. You have the different models. Going back to the social reason. Was it because we didn't spend enough money on response? Or no, we didn't spend enough money on detection, so we didn't know that we had spyware in our thing. Why didn't we spend enough money? Was that a technical reason or was a social reason? So when you're looking at these incidents, say, okay, yeah, this, the trouble is when you're looking at it through the press and getting these ones, you're never going to find that out, but you can maybe. Okay. So I'm giving you, and then in the assignment, look at the system and focus. So in this case, I'm looking at an incident that occurred with Telenor. Telenor was hacked by India. Everybody knows about that one. There's a huge, and what's good about that one is there's so much published on that. Telenor is quite open about that. So, I think the is the stream still up? I guess it, I don't know. I don't know how many minutes I did. Right? Okay, good. So, any questions about the assignment? Go out, look, find things interesting, and don't just take the first one. Think about, okay, can I write 4 pages about this, what I got? Do I have to dig deeper? In a sense, the trouble with this type of approach as a scientist is that you're looking for incidents that match the model, right? So in a sense, you're looking for stuff to validate the model, and that's not the purpose. The purpose is to get you to think, do practical things with the theoretical model. Whether the model's right or wrong, that's hard to say. So in many cases, maybe the model doesn't help you understand or explain the incident. And what do you do as a scientist? You say, okay, well, the model's wrong. But in this case, you're doing this not as scientists, you're doing it as students, and you're just applying it to learn how to think about security in terms of abstract models. And I've given you 3 models. The culture structure method machine model, the security value chain model, and the SBC model. And if you want to invent your own model, go ahead. You might get an A in the course then, but I know. I guess that's a social technical, yes. In chapter 1, I describe what that Venn diagram I had before. There are things that are not complex enough in technology and not complex enough in social. So you have the situation where I call it a social technical problem. Yeah, I have something, but we say a password. Is that a social problem or a technical problem? So what's happened is that we have a new type of problem. So should I pass a policy or law saying that, should I have it that you're only using biometrics? Right? Because the password, the person has to remember it, and the machine has to have a certain limit, etc. I take a good one. Why do I have a CAPTCHA? You know, CAPTCHA. CAPTCHA. You know when you have to answer these stupid questions, what you look at an A, a B, a C, a D, and an E? You know how they mix up the letters when you're logging in? Why is that? And the bots and machines, you think they're technical or they're social technical? So the problem can be technical and the solution can be social technical. Right? So I'm trying to see the world as being a combination of social controls. We have laws. We've had laws for I don't know how long. We've had technology. But the way these things are integrating together in information systems, there's a new type of thing. So philosophically, we say a change in quantity has brought about a change in kind. And that's what this course is about. And that's why everybody's realizing that, okay, this is not just a technical reason. This is not just a social reason. This is something new. And we don't have the ethics. We don't have the structure. We don't have the method. And we don't have the machines to deal with this problem. And we need a combination of all 4 changes, yeah. That's a social technical insight. The question was, if you have a, I gave an example, I have to repeat the question, I just realized, you have to remind me to do that. So I gave an example how the culture wanted to change something, but the structure and the methods and machines were blocking it. That's an example of a social technical insecurity. Now, when we get into the next section on system thinking, remember the system above, the system below, and etc. depends who the attacker is. Right? So you cannot look at a security solution in isolation. If it's a good solution or not depends on, you have to do a risk assessment, it depends on who the attacker is. Because what will I do? What is, if the user is frustrated by the password, right? So the culture is saying, I want to use biometrics. Because that was the example I had in the other lecture when I talked about early adopters. So in the first lecture we talked about early adopters, and I will go to the board here and give an example. So this is the quantity of users in the systems, and these are the people, I don't know if you can see that, but these are the people that like new technology, and these are the people that hate new technology. They don't want change, right? And we do a mathematical modeling of them, and it looks like the quantity is like this, right? And we want to change something. We want to go in and change the... Then I have another unit here where the culture is like that, and this is new technology, and these hate new things. These people don't want any change, right? And it looks like that, right? So a lot is 30% of the people in the university don't like new technology. I come in with a new solution saying we're going to have smart cards. I would suggest that this system would be secure faster and more secure because you have people that are willing to accept smart cards as a login mechanism. This system wouldn't work as quickly. There would be insecurity here. What they would do is, if I log in with my smart card, I leave it in the machine, I don't want to do anything. I got other things to do than worry about security and the smart card. So that's a potential for a social technical risk. You can introduce it, but the possibility that the smart card technology be used inappropriately are higher with this population. Because you have to decide, how do you measure a culture? Right? Yes? Correct. Yeah. And it can be that you have some, yeah, that's exactly the answer. And we get into something called requisite variety. And this will be taught in the fourth lecture. But in the next lecture, we'll be looking at the textbook and we get to some real practical security issues. Interesting enough, in the textbook, it starts off with a very good abstract model of what security and risk is. But then it gets down to very concrete checklist. All right, so please buy the book. I will present as much as I can. I know some of you don't. But as I say, I think it's a good book if you want to be a security professional. There's a lot of good checklists in it. Talks about different standards. And see you in the next lecture. The assignments, you understand it. You're supposed to task one. Put a suggestion. I'm going to study Telenor's attack here or this one there. Give a reference to it so I can understand it. And I can give you some ideas whether you can actually write 4 to 5 pages on this in a good enough fashion. And I say, go ahead, and then you write it and hand it in before the end of the course. And ideally what I want you can try this, use the framework I gave you. And in that we have one where we have a computer case, And the other one, what we have, is a telecom service that I proposed in 1992. It was called the video contract service. So this is a new technology. So when you're introducing a new technology into a market, you should figure out, do we have the right social technical controls? Does the customer have the right social technical controls? And the reason we do that is, one, so the customer doesn't get that one, or two, we can make money on the weaknesses. So I'm selling service X, the customer says it's great, but they have to buy service Y to make it greater. All right, so that's the way they, you know, so everybody sold you firewalls. And then you have all these alarms going off and said, well, who's going to respond to these things, one? Ah, for this $20 a month, we will make sure that your firewall is updated. Well, I thought this was a security solution. Yes, for $20 a month is a good security solution. We give you the, but, you know, I mean, addresses change and all this, and we have a solution so that you need a service. You can't respond in time. You're going to have to spend $20 a month on updating your firewalls and putting in new virus fingerprints, et cetera, et cetera. But in a sense, you can get this software for free. It detects everything. What would I do? Well, you could, and just in case, we will sell you backup services. So if this occurs, that's how the business works. Some customers buy it and some don't. All right. That's the white hat, black hat analysis notion, okay? All right. Any other questions? So I'm going to have to remember to repeat the questions, but the online students, if you have questions, just send an email to me, or you will have the Skype sessions. All right. Thank you, and see you in 2 weeks. You have time to do the assignment. You saw in the PowerPoints all these different things going on. You can watch Schneier talk about social technical. You can sign up for the 28th to hear things in Norwegian about the new security law. Okay, thank you. Good luck on the assignments. Do something you think is interesting, of course. That's the most important.